I'm Sarah Haydo. It is an absolute pleasure to be back here in Brighton today with you all here. In 2017, I was really lucky enough to get a ticket to attend. If you look into this photo, way back there in the middle, I'm hiding over there waving along as you were all this morning to the photo from 2022. I work as a software engineer, currently a health tech startup in London that works with the NHS. Before that, I was working at the BBC on the BBC News website. There's a bit of a theme here, you might tell, kind of like public sector, kind of tech for good, that kind of thing. That's something that really interests me, web accessibility, how we can use technology to make the world a better place. So, today, I'll be talking to you all about digital exclusion in healthcare, what it means, who it affects, and how we can change it. So to start, let's begin with a story, going back in time for a bit. Not quite far as back as 2017, but to the summer of 2020. I, perhaps quite like a lot of folks in tech, was working from home. We were out of one lockdown and into another, had a break in between, all of that. I didn't see very many people, and so most of the photos from my photo reel are from the flowers and trees on my midday walk down the street. I was quite lucky that I was able to work from home, and it was quite seamless for me because I had my laptop. Here's my setup, like my laptop on a stand, keyboard, everything on my dinner table. And basically, instead of what I was usually working from home one day a week, and that became full-time, and I was basically constantly at home. Hands up, who had a similar experience? I'm just curious. Yeah? Yeah? Quite a lot, almost about half. Brilliant. So yeah, I was doing some things to distract myself. So hadn't learnt to crochet, that'll be my next, hopefully it doesn't need to take a pandemic for me to learn that, but I feel really inspired to try that. I was doing some crafting things. All of my socials with friends and family had moved online into Zoom. Here's me and some family attending a wedding online. And who'd have thought it? And during that, I was helping family like set up things. It's like, what is Zoom? How to download it? All of these types of things. Okay, being tech support. Now, in a room full of lots of people here, how many of you had to be technical to support somebody, one of your loved ones? Yes, yes, yes. Amazing, yes. You can really get to know what the user experience of something is, right? When trying to explain exactly what sequence of buttons and things someone should click. And when they say why, I was like, I don't know, I'm sorry. Right. In addition to all of this, all of concerts and conferences, which previously you had to travel to a specific venue and like consider travel, accommodation, all those things, some of them went online. And so for many people, they didn't have to do all of these things, and they could still attend. So there were theatre shows that you'd need to be on, like in Broadway in New York, but you could see them in London or anywhere else if you had an internet connection. And for friends who had chronic illnesses and disabilities, a whole world of experiences had opened up that previously were locked away from them. Alongside all of this, as all of this was happening, I was listening to the news, and I was checking the NHS website quite often, to be honest. I checked, checking any time someone said that their vaccinations would be ready for my age group, I'd be like refreshing and seeing when I could sign up. And then in summer 2021, I booked in for my vaccination. So I went onto the website. I didn't need to phone my GP, wait in the queue, stay on hold, none of that was needed. I just booked myself in, got a text message, and knew where to go. Really simple. And I wasn't alone in this. Over the course of that time, 20 million adults in the UK booked vaccinations online, and that's about 61 million vaccinations. For the vast majority of people, it was their first time using an online tool for healthcare reasons. And that's not all they were doing. It wasn't just vaccinations that people were using digital means. Video consultations had moved digital as well. So what is a video consultation, right? So instead of a patient physically needing to go to their GP surgery or a hospital and have a face-to-face conversation with a doctor, a nurse, a therapist, physio, you'd have that online, using online tools. Here's a mock-up of how an actual tool that was used is set up, with like healthcare professional on one side and a patient on the other. Patients booked in for the session, and they usually like receive a text on their phone with a link, and it takes them to a page where they can use the camera and microphone on their device, and they could have that conversation. This technology's been around for a while. It's not brand new. It didn't kind of spontaneously be created in 2021. But the need, the needs, as you're probably all aware, of like social distancing, not having lots of groups of people sitting in waiting rooms, meant that uptake of this technology shot up hugely. And actually, people working in surgeries, working in hospitals, were actively seeking out. They were talking to their providers, digital providers, to be like, how can we get technology here immediately? Because we need to serve our patients. Here's actually a quote from a patient who had a child and needed to see a specialist at a hospital. She said she didn't need to take the morning off work, pay for travel, have the inconvenience of waiting in a waiting room for an hour, not sure when an appointment will happen, being delayed, in order to have a 15-minute appointment. She could have that appointment in convenience of her own home. So there are so many benefits to using technology for these tools. So many people like me, booking my vaccination, like this patient here, who benefited hugely from the move to using websites and web technologies to address healthcare needs. However, not everyone was thinking, cool, that's benefited me and a whole bunch of other people, that's great. But who's actually missing out? Who isn't able to enjoy using these tools and make the most of them? Some people have patchy internet. A rural location up in Scotland. Some places are like this place, where if they were trying to book in their vaccination, they might get flaky internet. They wouldn't necessarily receive the text message immediately. Might be wondering, oh, is this going to work? Has it actually gone through? Has it not? Do I need to call my surgery? What's happening? So they don't necessarily have that reliability of having fast internet and consistent internet. And this isn't just rural places either. There are like blocks and hotspots even in large cities and towns and other places that just don't have connectivity at all. There are thousands and hundreds of thousands of people in the country who access digital services using assistive technologies. This is a photo of a woman using a laptop with a braille display. There are lots of different technologies there are. So you may have heard of screen readers and other types of tools that people use, and those are fantastic means in order to access digital content and communicate with other folks and consume content, healthcare content as well. However, not every website is set up in a way that has, as we've talked about before, a semantic HTML that is using the best practices in order for folks with assistive technologies to make the most of them. So this is a barrier. This can be a barrier. So that's another group of people that may be excluded. There are thousands of people who don't have fixed postal addresses. I'm based in London, and if you walk down pretty much any major street, especially in central London, you'll see a lot of people who are homeless and who may not have a fixed postal address. This is a photo of a traveller community in England. And generally, if you're unaware, rural traveller communities, they have a nomadic way of life. And there's a whole part of their culture is so to not have a fixed address somewhere, but to move around and things like that. And what was interesting is that some folks, actually, there's a barrier for them to receiving healthcare. So So there's a report in 2019 by a community called gypsytraveller.org that carried out a blind testing with calling up GP practices across the country and asking, basically saying that they were a patient and they'd like to register for to be a patient in that practice. 48% of GP practices contacted wrongfully refused to register that person. It's a legal right in order for everybody to have access, but they either had the wrong information or the system that they are using required them to have a postcode and that kind of information, and so they're like, oh, I can't do anything. And so those are people who, I mean, this was a study, but that represents a lot of people who are trying to access healthcare that were otherwise being prevented. Did you know that one in every five people in the UK are in poverty? Now, if you listen to the news, especially lately, you hear about the cost of living crisis, with bills increasing at a far, far higher rate than incomes. Many families, not just the poorest, will need to decide between like food and heating costs and whether to get the shiny new internet data package or even smartphone device. So digital exclusion is all of these things. It's from, as you said, as just said, not having a device in the first place, or having one but not being able to afford the internet package in order to use it effectively. It's having, maybe it's like that you have had those tools, right? But the barriers is that the app or the website doesn't support the way you need to interact with it. Digital exclusion is also the systems and processes that you have not being flexible enough to allow for your current way of life. And it's also not having the infrastructure around you to support you. In behavioral science, there's this model called the COMBI model. And this is something that we can use to try to make sense of all of this. There's so many different aspects of this that we've talked about. How do you kind of like categorize it and try and understand it so that we can try and address some of this? And so it's the COMBI, so an acronym there, which talks about capabilities, opportunities, and motivation as the three key factors for capable of changing behavior. And then in this case, behavior, we're talking about like addressing accessing healthcare and things. So, for example, capability is a person's ability to participate in actual activity. So, for example, they're able to search for an app online or download it and install it. That's a capability. Opportunity is about like external factors that make behavior possible. So that's like having access to a device, having access to the internet, things like that. And lastly, motivation, which I thought was really interesting because I hadn't really considered it before. These are the thoughts that are conscious or unconscious thoughts that really inspire that behavior to like access healthcare. So for example, as we were talking about before, groups of people who are historically marginalized and not able to access healthcare in the standard way via GP or something like that, they might be reticent to try over and over again to when they keep getting rebuffed, and that may impact their motivation. And then that in turn may impact how they behave in relation to healthcare in general. So yeah, so actually thinking about this, it's like a person's experience doesn't just fit neatly into a category either. There's like an overlap, and so some groups of people can be having experiences related to all of these. Okay, so that's a lot of things, right? What can we do to change things? How can we like pull apart all of these barriers that we've talked about and figure out how to make change happen? What principles should we think about? And what tangible difference can those in this room have? Not just something about in the future, maybe at some point, but like in the current day, like today, this week. So these are principles that I think are really important to think about in general. especially related to this, and it's to be research-led. And when I say research-led, also to be user-centered in that research. So carry out research, be user-centered. So those are terms. I've been working in tech for a few years, and I hear these kind of terms thrown around a lot. I'm not sure if you hear them or not a lot. And in a lot of cases, they're just like things that like sound like shiny, like jargony words, right? But I particularly want to emphasize being user-centered rather than product-centered. Because I don't know about you, but when we, in a lot of cases, when you talk about research and you work in a team that's making websites or apps, we're thinking about research. How well does my app do with a group of people? How does this web page, have an impact on a person? And we're not actually thinking about what the user, or in this case, a patient's real experience is. We're not really focused on their lives and what they need. We're really focused on our products and like validation for the things that we're doing. So yeah, so I think this is a particularly important thing to think about, to really be focused on the user, or in this case, patients. And talking about it being holistic. So not just considering the 10 minutes that they're gonna spend on your website trying to book an appointment or something like that, or trying to get a video call set up, but think, how does that fit into their day, their lifestyle? Talked about earlier how some folks don't have fixed addresses. In a lot of cases, that means they won't be able to register for a local library. That means they won't be able to access free computers and internet, and all sorts of things like that. And so somebody might be like, oh, they can get access if they really try. Well, yeah, would you like to have your private doctor's conversation in a local library when you've got lots of people listening in? I'm sure I wouldn't. So let's now go through some aspects where we can take some of the research that's already been carried out by other people and find out what they've learned and figure out how we can apply that to our everyday. So starting out with simplify. What can we do to simplify things? So 15% of adults in England have English literacy levels at the age of 9 to 11 years old. So that's called entry levels, 1 to 3. I was quite surprised at that. One thing that you might have noticed is that healthcare content has a whole bunch of jargon and acronyms. And if you've ever actually asked for a printout of a conversation that your GP's had with like a consultant in the hospital, it can be kind of terrifying because you have all these contents of like something is calcified and all of that, and you're like, oh my God, am I going to get arthritis? Like, what is this? And apparently it's just that you broke your toe a few years ago and there's something there, and it's like, okay, cool. Lots of jargon. Terrifying, right? But yeah, so what can we do about that? We can use plain language. Those of you who are in libraries a lot as a kid, like I was, might find this icon, this stamp familiar. It's on the back of a bunch of books and textbooks and things like that. So this is a logo by the Plain English campaign. And if like a pamphlet or a book or something is like meets the standards, you could apply to have it approved. You can even have a website approved. I remember seeing some of these ages ago on like HTML websites at the bottom of those. And what that means is that we're using plain language. And we talked about plain language being important for, like, you know, it could be 15%, probably more of the population. But also it will be helpful for folks with learning disabilities, simplifying the language. How about the many people where English is an additional language? Maybe they're on top of the other languages they know already, but they're using idioms and like phrases and casual language and interspersed with acronyms and jargon and all of this type of thing. It's quite overwhelming, so we can use plain language. Well, what does that really mean, plain language? Here's an example that's on the Plain English website. Specifically, there's a section on the medical information, which is quite interesting. And it's some of the quite straightforward things, you'd think. So it's taking something from using passive voice and using general terms, like general categories like patients, and talking and changing that to the active voice and talking you directly, you are the patient, and simplifying some terms. So before, an information helpline is also operated by ABC Hospital Trust for the convenience of patients. And changing that to, we also run an information helpline for your convenience. How do you feel hearing one versus the other? Hopefully the idea is that it's talking to you in a really helpful way, as though somebody is explaining something to you directly, and not that you're kind of reading a user manual somewhere. Health literacy is your ability to understand and make decisions about your health. And so if we make the language that we use plainer and simpler, it's not just going to affect a few people, it's going to impact all of our understanding and our ability to have better health literacy and understand what's going on with our own bodies and our own health, and be able to make decisions that can impact us in a positive way. So 4 in 10 adults struggle with consuming health content. And that's actually, it's over 6 in 10 struggle with content that includes stats. And that's like stats, not just like numbers like this, but also like tables and graphs and like the comparison of things like that. So, so your doctor might give you a BMI chart. That might be quite confusing for somebody trying to figure out what they're supposed to do with that, etc. And there's lots more complicated things as well. We can really improve every single person's health literacy by taking these steps in order to simplify our setup, simplify our processes, and improve them. When you design with the most marginalized people at the center, you improve the experience for everybody. So, let's go on to some other ways that we can do things. So there is a website with the NHS Content Style Guide. It's a brilliant site. It's got topics in terms of like how to talk to patients, how to do that in the written form, and also to clinicians, things like that. And to be honest, if you're not doing anything related to healthcare, I still highly recommend having a look, because it's got great principles that like any written format of anything would be helpful for. And my favorite thing, actually linking up from this page, is this story. My favorite anecdote. They did some research in terms of how patients react to the terms that they get sent. So like, so let's say we talked about like calcification of bones, but things like, oh, you need to give a stool sample ready for your appointment at the hospital. And whether people actually understood what that meant, whether there were questions. Actually, they made like a decision overall across the board to change the word and decide against using the words we and stool, instead pee and poop, because that worked best. So, hey. In addition to the language that we talked about, you can simplify technical complexity. And cool, we're in a room of people who care about tech and work in tech in various different ways, or have an interest in interacting with tech. And so here, technical doesn't necessarily mean what you or I might call technical, in terms of like, you know, needing to spin up a server or build a website or things like that. It's how you interact with technology as well. So I don't know about you, but the way, when I kind of encounter a new website, I like to click on everything. I like going to the menu, figure out what's on there, and like go into the footer, and like click a toggle and see what that button does, and all that kind of thing. But there's lots of research that's been carried out that shows that there's quite a large percentage of the population that's pretty much terrified of doing that. They're terrified of breaking things. Terrified that, especially if it's related to healthcare, that like if they do the wrong thing, then that might lead to like their GP not getting a message, or something going wrong and their consultation being put back. And it creates a lot of anxiety for some people as well. And so we're talking about simplifying technical complexity, talking about the real, like, simple everyday things. So reducing the number of interactions that you need to get to full content. So this is an example that is, like, I've recreated. It's not exactly how I've seen it, but it's pretty much similar to this, where there's this bit of text which looks like a link, so I was like, I know, I'm going to click it. Does it take me to the web page? What does it do? And actually, it had this little tooltip which gave the address. And I was like, why? Why do this? And like looking at the rest of the page in context, it could kind of tell that they wanted to like simplify the page layout and make like it was in a wider card, and they wanted to like make it and like make it in line with the buttons and all of that and make it look pretty and like lean so it looked like a mobile fare. But you're adding complexity there. It doesn't need to be there. Could just have it below or things like that. You don't need to hide things in accordions all the time that need somebody to like tap 10 things to get to the end and see the content. Make things simple. Reduce that technical complexity, if I can say that word. Have a single action per page. This is another principle that's talked about in the content style guides and probably a lot of like gov.uk websites and public sector services as well. Is have a single action per page here. If you use the booking system online for your vaccination, you've probably got to this page quite a lot. What is your NHS number? One clear action, one field to fill in, and one action to submit that and continue to the next page. You don't have a whole form of like, okay, what appointment do you want and what this and all this is all on the same page. No, you've got one action, it's really clear, and then you can move on to the next stage. No distractions at all. So another aspect that we can think about, a principle, is to give users choice. So I just talked about taking away choice in some way, giving users choice, what's happening here. And it's about not forcing users to interact in a certain way. So, equality is giving everyone the same web form to book their appointment in and saying that's it. That's all you're going to use. No other options. Diagram is, there's lots of different versions of similar ones online that you may have seen. There's equality is on the left, and it's everyone's given the same tool to use. And some people face different barriers and fewer barriers, and they can use that just fine. And other people have more barriers to that, and that tool doesn't cut it. And so equity is actually either changing that tool in order to make it more useful to folks who need it, or replacing that with another one that does a job better. So it's giving users the choice that work for them can lead to them having an equity in their experience. So what could that mean with regards to like digital access and healthcare and things? So one thing that I recently found out was that in the NHS, whenever they're deciding to award contracts to technology providers, so let's say a company that enables video calls or something like that, because that's not all done in-house in the NHS, they contract that out in a lot of cases. Then that NHS trust often, or body, rates the services of organisations and like compares them against a set number of criteria. And one quite important aspect that those companies offer one important aspect which those companies are like rated on is their approach to digital inclusion. So, do they have an alternative to the web form, like a phone line, so that people who have questions about their, filling in their appointment booking can really talk to somebody and have those fears like assuaged and like have those questions that they have answered. I know that last time I wanted some more information on like a website, it went, there's usually like a web chat in the corner and you click on it and it's like the worst thing ever. Because it's like, it can be kind of flaky, or sometimes there's a bot that makes it sound like it's a human, it's got a human face on it. And you're typing and I was like, you're not a human. And then it's like, and you type it in some more, and it kind of says, can you repeat that, please? And you try something else, and you can repeat that, please? And it's like, you try something else, like, can you just, like, get me to a human, or just say that you don't know, or just give me the full list? Like, any of those options will do. And that's, like, I'm quite familiar with this. This can be quite frustrating for somebody who doesn't know how to, like, hack around the algorithm of a web chat on a website. That can, like, that kind of experience related to healthcare could, like, put somebody off from accessing, like, trying to get an appointment entirely. And, like, that can impact their own healthcare outcomes. So it's not just a tiny little widget on a website. It can really have monumental impact. And this is a quote from a healthcare professional when they were talking about how they're using healthcare and digital healthcare through the pandemic and after. Well, still through. Whole discussion there. But moving into the future, was digital first should not mean digital only. So allow those traditional methods and approaches to live alongside the cutting edge ones. So let's talk about another aspect here. Learning about lived experiences. Learning about all of your lived experiences, patients' experiences. Research, research, research. I can't state how useful this is. It can be a fantastic way to understand barriers that people are facing. And it's important to not just like focus on like that bulk of folks, like the 90, 80%, the people who are really vocal, people if you send out an email to your users and they reply and they say, yeah, I'm really eager, because they're probably the people who will vocally complain if there's an issue or like really be proactive and engaged. No, you need to actually get somebody or you or somebody else to go out into the community to find the people who are not interacting with your services at all. Work with community groups and people on the ground who work with people who don't have fixed postal addresses, who don't have fixed addresses, who don't have internet access reliably in their homes, who are using assistive tech, and bring those people into like this kind of a research lab. This might be really intimidating. People don't have time. People might have lots of jobs. So you need to change the way you do your research. Go to where they live. So this is a photo from my previous job when I was at BBC News, and we did some accessibility user research into how people are navigating a new website and whether like the headings and buttons and links and like sections all made sense. And it's fascinating. So some people were like local to London and were really happy to come into this lab. And some, there was actually, the user research went to people's homes in order to actually experience how they were interacting with things. So we had people that use Switch devices, which is an assistive tech, in order to access content on websites. And that is their comfort zone, and that's how in their own home using their own tools, and that's how we got a lot of more information about what their barriers were in order to using our website in that case. But it's also relevant for anything really, whether it's a website or an app or anything else. So yeah, can't underestimate how important research is. And then once you've done that, it's to take that qualitative data that you have, that quite rich data from folks who are experiencing quite a lot of barriers, and bring those into your everyday processes. So what does that look like? So it can be figuring out that, oh, that particular device that encountered issues when going through tabs and through our page, or our pages, this page is really, really slow to load. You need to figure out why. Let us replicate that in our office using some test devices. Not using our shiny mobiles that are the latest thing, but actually using the things that actual users, actual patients are using. And previously, because talking about how to make our world greener and things, and making things lighter, and making web pages performant using like HTML, CSS, all of these types of things. All of these have a real impact on real people. And so this kind of loop of doing some research and then also implementing, like testing regularly in-house, at home, it can be even at home, you could probably find a really, really old mobile on eBay for not that much and try using that. Tethering that to your phone, see what a flaky connection could look like, all sorts of things like that. Highly recommend it. Here's another aspect that we can talk about, building trust. I think this is quite an interesting one because it's about building relationship. I think Lawrence earlier said about how you can't design something if you don't have a relationship with that community or the group. And yes, it's that building that trust. And how can you do that? It's that communication. This will take time. By definition, if you're creating something, you have a relationship with the person that uses it. You might not know them. They might not know you. But there is a relationship there. There's a relationship there. It might be a corporate website where they're just buying something. It might be one of enjoyment and joy, like a personal website that has fun games and things like that. All sorts of things there. But there is a relationship there. And I think it's fascinating to think about, and particularly in the realms of healthcare and health tech, how we can build trust and really go to folks and communities and say that, you know, we are listening, and that we actually care about your experiences. You might not know how to address them right now, and that's fine. But being open and honest about that really, really can lead to trust. So, talked about things that we could do, plain language and all of these types of things, building trust. What about all of these other systemic barriers to digital inclusion? We talked about things like poverty and all of these things that seem like so huge, right? What can I do about that? Well, there are organizations that are already trying to do things already. So the Good Things Foundation has done a lot of research into digital exclusion and as a result set up two really great services. One is a national device bank, making devices, so like mobiles, tablets, laptops, available to those who need them most. And they find who needs the most, how do you find that? So they actually partner with local community grassroots groups who really are embedded in communities. And they also partner with folks who have lots of devices. So maybe if your company has a lot of phones and laptops and things like that that they don't need, or that they're, you know, upgrading to the latest shiny new Macs, and you've got a whole bunch of other things, give them a shout. You can donate them. Okay, cool. They'll be like, okay, somebody who is who's contacted by that community partner is identified as like they need a device to access their healthcare or important services, and they're given one. But what use is that if they don't have a reliable connection or to internet and things like that? There is the National Data Bank, also set up by the Good Things Foundation, which provides free internet data, like minutes, texts, to 500,000 people nationally. And they're working with telecoms organizations in order to provide that. So there are lots of these organizations, and this is just like one example. And yeah, so one way to impact them, this is actually a charity. So they rely on donations and volunteers and things like that in order to function. And then you might think, cool, so there's charities, that's great, right? They're doing the things that we need them to do. They do a lot. But why do we need to rely on charitable donations in order to get this stuff happening? It doesn't really have to be that way. As mentioned earlier, there's a lot of capital somewhere hidden in the UK. Some people might be finding it difficult to get access to a lot of it right now, but there is. You know, we're probably fifth or sixth the richest country in the world. That means a lot, right? And there are Yeah, and there are a lot of things that that can be done here. There are several campaign groups and research bodies that are working in tandem with like grassroots organizations in order to change the status quo. As you may know, that access to shelter, to education are considered universal human rights. And here in this country, we have a National Health Service, right? And it's something that I and I know a lot of people I know are proud of. So I think it's fair to say, you know, healthcare here is considered a human right as well. And that everyone deserves access to it, no matter what their means are, their backgrounds are, or barriers there are in society. And then now that we're using technology and the internet and digital means in order to further that, the reach of healthcare, the impact that healthcare can have, the improvements that they have, surely the internet, therefore, becomes, access to the internet becomes a human right as well. So yeah, there's a lot here. There's a lot can be done. There are lots of actual organizations that are actively impacting and are working in this space. One thing that I found really interesting was a conversation. So I work, as I mentioned earlier, I work in a health tech organization that was was focusing in the pandemic to support NHS services and enable people to book vaccinations. And one of the things that I found out after the fact was that during the pandemic, I'm not sure if I should be saying this or not, but I've heard it, so whatever. During the pandemic, there were some discussions about how, you know, the booking system was online and things like that, and whether it would be possible to zero rate healthcare like texts that you'd get or receive, and like zero rate internet-related like searches and things related to healthcare, and you know, video calls that you're having with your doctors and consultants in like whether it's a GP or a hospital and things like this. And that was really interesting to me. Because what happened is that process was taking time, right? But there were three people like telecoms organizations, like government policymakers, like tech companies, all kind of having discussions about this. Because there was like lots of pressure. There was like this whole impact of like we need to improve things for people. But nothing quite came of that there. But that makes that leaves the door open, right? What that makes it possible for that to happen. That makes it possible, a possible thing in the future. So, talked about breaking barriers to digital inclusion. Talked about a whole bunch of different things that you can do, whether it's in your everyday, you know, carrying out research, simplifying things, language technologies, choices leading to greater equity, learning lived experiences, building trust, supporting grassroots organizations that are doing real good there, and influencing policy too. So, breaking barriers to digital inclusion. It's all in your hands. Thank you.